Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Here we go. It's Supreme Court time. And this week, the umpires of power handed down a 5-4 decision that could take that good old tried-and-true water cycle and just eliminate it and replace it with dirt and sand and houses and shopping malls. It's a free fall into free markets when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. This last week, the Supreme Court made a decision. We hear about Supreme Court decisions all the time, and this one is one that I'm sure snuck below the radar screen, many radar screens, because it had to do with the Clean Water Act. And for a lot of people, this kind of it just slips right by them. But actually, this may have tremendous significance for public lands and private lands, which probably is the main issue. So a 5-4 Supreme Court decision having to do with a case that dealt with water rights. This is a very complex issue. These water rights issues are, because water has its own mind. It goes where it wants to. Fortunately, it serves us all because it keeps us all alive. And so where water goes and how it gets there and what may block it has terrific significance to many living things. To help us understand why this is important to us, we're now talking with John Devine, who is an attorney with the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council. John, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you, Sydney.
This is a complex issue. This has to do with the courses of water, natural water, and give us a sense of why this has significance.
Sure. Well, what the cases involve are what kinds of water bodies the Clean Water Act will apply to, and that's all of the protections of the Clean Water Act, which protects waterways from sewage, from industrial toxins, and from oil spills, from being filled in altogether by dredge and fill material.
I think the most critical element here is what constitutes a waterway, a protected waterway, and this otherwise designated a wetland. Help us understand how that has been determined and why that's important in this case.
What's at issue in these cases is what constitutes a water of the United States, which are protected by the Clean Water Act and have been since 1972. What the court ultimately wasn't able to reach agreement about is exactly what waters meet that definition. That's unfortunate because we were hoping for some clarity from the Supreme Court about what waters would be protected, and more to the point, we were hoping that the court would confirm a long-standing view that waters broadly are protected by the Clean Water Act, not certain special kinds of waters.
Well, this case revolves around, actually, I don't know if it's two separate cases. Is it two separate cases?
It was two separate cases.
Mm-hmm. But they had a related point in law.
Exactly.
And this was brought by John A. Rapinos and June Carabel. These are the two defendants in this case? How does this work in this situation?
In the Supreme Court, they're called petitioners. But, yes, they had each lost in the Court of Appeals below, and in both cases, the Court of Appeals had said that the wetlands that they were proposing, or in Mr. Rapinos's case, had developed, they were requesting that those not be considered waters of the United States and therefore not be protected by the Clean Water Act.
Now, these are two people who own property, and there's nothing that, you know, we all want to own property. And, of course, this is, I think, where this war is really raging, and that is the rights of a property owner to do what they want with their land. You know, if a person, particularly if they're in business, if they invest in property, which we all invest in property, our homes are our business property in a sense, because we can make a lot of money off of these kinds of things. Some people buy land because they want to develop it, and that's the case here. Both of these people had intentions to develop their lands, and so they had an economic interest in using the land, and so they proceeded to do that. They started to develop the lands, and in the case of Mr. Rapinos, he actually started to alter his lands, and maybe give us a little background on what happened and why that's important.
What these particular cases involve are wetlands that are next to tributaries to the Great Lakes. And what Mr. Rapinos did was to actually undertake activity at some of his sites to fill in, to drain and fill in the wetlands there. The other case involved a person named Carabel who had proposed to do something similar. Obviously, the filling in of wetlands or the draining of them is important for the tributaries right there and for the larger water bodies that they lead into. Those wetlands provide habitat for resident and migratory animals. They filter pollution before it gets to larger water bodies and hurts what lives there and it impairs drinking water that we all use, and these wetlands also provide significant flood water storage. Taking the law into your own hands is something that we should discourage. And instead, what the government had argued and what we supported was that these wetlands ought to be considered protected by the Clean Water Act, and these folks ought to obtain a permit before filling them in. That would ensure that they did the least damage to the water resource possible.
Now, a lot of their case rested on interpretation of words such as navigable and tributary. I think perhaps they were trying to make the case that these waters really weren't of any significance in terms of becoming a tributary to the larger bodies of water. And that's kind of where this, again, this point of law becomes minusculated. It just becomes, there's a lot of minutiae in that. Help us understand what their case.
I think they were primarily trying to argue that the Clean Water Act, at least Mr. Rapinos was trying to argue that the Clean Water Act only applies to water bodies that you can float a boat in that are navigable. The Supreme Court roundly rejected that, and fortunately so. That would taking navigable waters to be the only protected waters under the Clean Water Act would be a tremendous loophole in the law. It would cut out at something near 60% of the stream miles in the lower 48 states. Unfortunately, the court did step back from traditionally broad coverage of the Clean Water Act, and that took a couple forms. Justice Scalia, who was joined by three other justices, would have gone very far and cut out waterways that did not have a continuous and relatively permanent flow in them, and especially in the West. Those are quite common. There are nearly 2 million miles of such waterways in the lower 48. Justice Kennedy, on the other hand, suggested that before the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers could protect a water, that they would have to show somehow that the water in question was biologically or chemically important to the overall aquatic system, and that's going to create some procedural hurdles in practice, which we're troubled by.
I guess their case also suggests that, I guess in one case, their property was 20 miles away from the nearest lake. Is that right? 20 miles? Something like that?
That is the case at one of, I believe, one of Mr. Rapinos' properties, but the point to bear in mind here is that the wetland that was there also abutted a tributary to the Great Lakes, and as my six-year-old understands when pollution is put into a smaller water body, it flows downstream to the larger one.
That's the way it works. Water flows downstream. That's exactly right. And as well, it percolates into the ground and forms the basis of our water tables. And
absolutely. If you pollute streams that serve as drinking water sources for us, that creates costs for cleanup and endangers public health.
So just to kind of reiterate, it seems what the Supreme Court did was it reversed a case, a ruling that was against these defendants in the lower courts, therefore, in essence, reversing the constraints that were placed upon them to not change or alter their designated wetland, the areas that were considered wetlands by law, by the lower courts. And so what this, in essence, does, or perhaps in fact, is it suddenly opens up a tremendous number of potential situations where people are dredging their wetlands and filling in wetland areas because now they have the protection of law. Is that right?
I think it remains to be seen.
Well, good point. I'm just saying it could lead to that.
Fortunately, Justice Scalia, who would have dramatically opened up the Clean Water Act with his view of the law, only got three justices to join him, so that view of the law did not command a majority of the Supreme Court. Justice Kennedy had a much more narrow view of what EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers have to do to protect waters before, and so that is still troubling because I think it creates practical problems for people who want to protect waters, but it's certainly not the wholesale gutting that I think you would have seen if Justice Scalia's view had prevailed.
Well, now this is interesting. I just learned something, I think. Then, and that is that in the decisions of these courts, depending on, because the Supreme Court justices actually do interpret their rulings, that therefore this ruling becomes nuanced because it is a split decision.
That's right. There's a fractured opinion here, basically. There are four justices for a big new loophole. There are four justices who would have upheld the Clean Water Act's protections to these water bodies, and there's Justice Kennedy in the middle. As a result, I think we're going to see a lot more individual case-by-case fights and unfortunately additional litigation over which waters are going to be protected. And that's why we think that Congress, who after all wrote the Clean Water Act 30-some years ago and knows what it meant in doing so, ought to step in and clear up the rules.
I don't think we should hold our breath on that. It's pretty obvious that the court decision followed the conservative and liberal lines in this case. So what it ultimately means is there is no clear decision, and therefore there's going to be a lot of indecision in terms of our future here. Yeah.
Yeah, and like I said, but Congress can fix that, and I'll put in a plug again because there are bills in both houses that have already been introduced and would fix the confusion that the Supreme Court has unfortunately sent back to the agencies and to the lower courts.
Now, do you know who's introducing those bills?
There's in the House there are some 150 some co-sponsors of a bill called the Clean Water Authority Restoration Act, and that's roughly a dozen folks on the Senate side. The bill would simply reaffirm the protections that the Clean Water Act has provided for 30 some years. It would specify that EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers would need to protect the waters that have been protected for decades.
Does this come down sort of fundamentally to this ancient old battle that goes on between protections that are set up for the public good versus protections that are set up for the private good, the personal protections for property? It does sort of come down to that, doesn't it? Because, I mean, the water is this thing that crosses many, many properties. That's probably where the conflict arises. So is it sort of based on that?
Well, yes. I mean, frequently a polluter will be a private property owner or a developer who's trying to fill in a water on his or her property. But as you point out, that's not where these issues stop. Water is a shared resource, and pollution added on somebody's property to a stream that flows through many properties and ultimately to larger bodies of water affect many people downstream. Millions of us get our drinking water from small streams and rivers, and it is imperative that we be able to protect those from individuals who would otherwise pollute them. And what the Clean Water Act does is simply say, before you add pollution or fill in a protected water, you have to get a permit that minimizes your impact.
Is there anything that you feel people can actually do?
They certainly can urge that Congress enact the Clean Water Authority Restoration Act, which would protect the waters that have historically been protected by the Clean Water Act. And they can also, you know, take action at the local level. They can make sure that their own neighborhood and nearby streams are being looked after and that people aren't abusing them.
John Devine, who works with the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, you guys are really at the forefront so often of these kinds of cases. And if it weren't for you, I don't know who'd be doing this type of thing, because individuals really can't take on these cases. So tell us a little bit about the NRDC and how people can find out more about what you folks are doing.
Sure. NRDC is a nationwide organization of members. We have over a million members and online activists. We have offices in California, New York, and Washington, D.C., we're online at www.nrdc.org.
John Devine with the NRDC, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you so much, Sydney.
I wonder, really, if it's smart to take all the wisdom and wonder of God and the planets and moon and stars that spun this little earthly haven into being and rip it apart and sell it off in chunks. People need to take a stand, really, speak up, stand up, speak out, unite, and serve as the strong arms of truth. We keep it coming every week, the voice of the earth, your voices of the earth. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios, until we meet again, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth calls out, here on the Wild Side News.
Shadows and footprints mirror the movements of moon and tide. Magnificent families glide perfectly calm, nurturing children. Why must we kill them with thoughtless hands? They're part of a perfect plan, and brother to man. Will this be our fate? Can we come to understand?